You heard Danny Mac, you heard Dodgers Radio, you heard, of course, from the Cardinals skipper, Mike Schilt, and Chris Ronji, Randy Carricker with you. I thought the two-point conversion was a little unnecessary there.
Well, you want to make sure they don't come back,
yeah.
Right? Hey, you're in the lead, you might as well step on the throat and make sure that you've ended things. Cardinals baseball, by the way, is making poor Danny Mac sick.
Literally.
Poor guy.
Yeah.
Struggling now, up there, but he's powering through.
He's doing a great job of powering through. You might think we're going to joke a little bit about what Mike Schilt said. He said, it's the best stuff we've seen from Michael Wacha in a while. The reason for that is that the last time Michael Wacha pitched was July 27th.
Okay. Well,
so it's been what, 10 days or so?
Technically.
So not 9 days. So, yeah.
It's not really a lie.
It's not. It's the best they've seen of him in at least 9 days.
Randy, it is just a stretching of the truth. It's not necessarily wrong, yeah. I guess, but it might not be right. I don't know. Whatever it was, I know this. There were 14 balls put in play against Michael mm-hmm. Wacha in fair territory. 8 of them were hard hit.
Yeah.
6 of them were hit over 100 miles an hour, which is hard, hard hit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 2 of them at 95 miles an hour. So for somebody who has good stuff, they're not getting hit like that in the first few innings of their starts.
The only real movement on his pitches is when it drops out of the strike zone. He's trying to throw that sinker, and he can't throw that sinker low and in the zone. And the opposing hitters are forcing him to get it up. And then you go middle against a guy like Bellinger, bing, bang, boom, 3-run homer, and pretty much game over in the first inning.
Yep, that was it. It was that home run, which in the first, that one was hit 109 miles an hour. Okay. That's pounded, right? That's a ball that is absolutely scalded. And you could tell early he didn't. You can get guys to chase if your other stuff is good enough. And if that pitch is not, if they're not able to recognize what's coming, you can get them to chase out of the zone. The problem is his other stuff isn't good enough to hide that fact. And that ball coming out of the hand doesn't look like everything else. So they can lay off it and they can wait for the pitch they want.
And when he was new, and people didn't know about that changeup, he was a different pitcher. Now that they know, well, we can put it in perspective here. This is from Eric Steffen at SB Nation. Wacha in the 2013 NLCS had 2 scoreless starts against the Dodgers. Since then, in 8 regular season starts against them, he's got a 7.30 earned run average, 12 runs allowed in 7 1/3 innings in 2 starts this year. So he's a different pitcher, and the approach against Michael Wacha is different. And by the way, the Cardinals called up a reliever today, a former starter, Junior Fernandez. But that might do one of two things, or it might do two things. It might move Ryan Helsley into the rotation as, and you've suggested this, an opener. And then Fernandez is the kind of guy that can give you a couple of innings and get you to that 6th inning where you start to use your bullpen in earnest.
Well, I don't know if I actually like the idea of the opener so much. I certainly don't like using it regularly, but I'm not totally opposed to the idea. Let's put it that way. And at this point, the Cardinals need innings. Right. And mm-hmm. it doesn't matter where it's coming from. With 2 months left to go, less than 2 months left to go in the season, they have to find a way to get innings. Ideally, it's going to come from your starters. All right. And you're not going to have to rely so much on your bullpen, because I think you're going to gas them out by the time you get to September, which that's a recipe for not going to the playoffs. It's very easy to miss the playoffs because you've taxed your bullpen too much through the regular season. And I think they have thrown too many innings now. Is that going to work out for them? I don't know. What would have made me feel a whole lot better, and I know this is beating a dead horse and we are so far beyond it, nothing can be done, but I would have felt a whole lot better if they had picked up some help at the deadline. I would have felt even better than that had they picked up some help in the offseason when there were guys available that they could have brought in to help them handle that workload. We're past it now. Nothing we can do about it. You just have to hope that Fernandez and Helsley, if they ask him to do that job, can help in a meaningful way. That's where we are right now, throwing stuff at the wall and hoping something sticks.
Right. Last time Wacha pitched well was June 28th against the Padres. He went 7 innings, allowed 2 earned runs. The Cardinals wound up losing the game anyway, and he was the loser in the decision. Before that, he had 4-6 and 2 1/3 inning outings. The only time that he has gone beyond 6 innings this year was that outing. And the Cardinals need more than six. As a matter of fact, he's given them six. Let's see, 2 out of 5. He did not give them 6 in May. 3 out of 5 in June. So 5 out of 15, 5 out of 19 starts. He's given them as many as 6 innings and allowed the bullpen to take over in the 7th.
So when Michael Wacha was pitching last night and they were in the 4th inning, which is the only inning he got into, or the last inning he got into, I was starting to think to myself, all right, this game is probably a loss here. They're not going to come back and beat the Dodgers. They're already down by 5 or 6. I think it was 6 at that moment. Maybe it's one of those where he just kind of needs to wear it and pitch another couple of innings. I know they got the off day coming up on Thursday, but as often as they can possibly get their starter to get into the 6th inning, loss or not, you're going to have to take those opportunities. And maybe it was just there was no way he was going to get through 6. That may not have happened for them last night. But I was internally thinking, man, let's maybe let him wear this and kind of help out the bullpen tonight. But they couldn't get him through.
And I know there are a lot of people out there that are wanting to DFA Michael Wacha. How would you like to DFA Michael Wacha and have happen to you what happened to Toronto when they traded Aaron Sanchez last week? Because it's not out of the realm of possibility that somebody else could unlock what ails him, find that key, and get him going again. And if you're the Cardinals, you don't want somebody else to figure out that Wacha, oh, yeah, he's throwing 97. All we have to do is this little tweak, and he's fine.
The Astros did it in one start. Yep. And what they did was they flipped the amount of times he was throwing his sinker versus his curve. He was all sinker, like sinker, 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 and then the curve was a smaller percentage of that. They flipped it, and he pitched scoreless, no-hit innings.
Six no-hit innings, yeah.
So, yeah, I don't want that to happen. What I would like to see happen, though, is, and I think there was a little bit of promise coming from him pitching out of the bullpen, right?
Yeah, he actually had some good outings.
And so...
Not great, but... Okay outings.
Yeah, I mean, outings you can live with. And the kind of outings I guess they need, well, they really need tremendous outings, but whatever you can get that keeps you in a ball game, that's where we are at this point. I'd rather have him go back in the bullpen and maybe give them some meaningful innings there.
Yeah, and that's the only thing you can do. And hopefully they will, well, they DFA'd Adalberto Mejia today. And we mentioned that they brought up Junior Fernandez. Mike Myers, by the way, has been outrighted to Memphis. Michael Wacha is going to be on your roster unless they can find an injury.
Right.
And so what he's got to be what he was against Houston without allowing the grand slam, where he went 4 2/3 out of the pen. He allowed one run, but he did allow all three of the runners that were on base when he came into the game to score. That's what he needs to be. He needs to be that guy when you're down by a score of 5-1 that comes in and gives you 4 2/3.
Michael, this was great. Other than the grand slam, he did a really nice job. Yeah. I just want you to know.
He actually did.
Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln.
Aside from his first pitch.
That was the play.
He needs the Jeff Fisher. Yeah, we commissioned the commissioner remove that part of the season.
Here's what I know, Randy. We're going to get that fixed for you.
Let's fix that. Good, I like
it. Somebody's going to have to fix it.
It's the Fast Lane on 101 ESPN. Cardinals fall 8-0 to the Dodgers, but it's baseball, and they get another opportunity tonight against L.A. and Clayton Kershaw.
What?
Just saying.
They've beaten him before.
Oh, yeah. When Matt Adams was here, when Pete Cosma was here. Yeah, good luck tonight.
Is Pete Cosma available?
I think he might be. We need him now. Hey, remember when the Cardinals fans admired Mike Schilt for his honesty and openness with the media? Well, he doesn't seem to be doing the same thing these days. That's next on 101 ESPN. That's the Cardinals skipper, Mike Schilt, Dan McLaughlin, battling through flu.
Is that the flu? He's got the actual flu.
Yeah.
Damn, man. If I got the flu, I ain't going to work.
Actually, in the last couple of days, he has vomited into trash cans a couple of times.
That's what they call a gamer.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I could do that.
I told him today, I said, use Sudafed and Mountain Dew. I don't know if he's going to try it, but that's the one thing. If you want to get rid of the flu, it's Sudafed and
that is a Randy home remedy.
It is. Yeah. And this doesn't apply to Danny, but it used to be Jack Buck told me one time that the flu was God's way of telling you you needed to lose weight.
Jeez.
He did that to me when I had the flu one time.
Son of a... Are you kidding me? You know what? I've often told you that one of my favorite, I guess, qualities in a person is when they're able to tell you exactly what they think to your face. I appreciate it. Even if it's harsh, I do appreciate it. And you know what? Mr. Buck, thank you.
It was funny.
Oh, I love it.
So Mike Schilt last night trying to make Michael Wacha sound better than he really was. And you can parse it and you can say, yeah, okay. The only bad pitches he made were the ones that got hit for home runs or doubles or whatever. But Michael Wacha was bad last night, and Schilt can talk about his stuff. But the fact of the matter is he doesn't want to throw his player under the bus, especially a guy who's already tortured and fans didn't want to see back in the starting rotation anyway. And Schilt is just, as most managers will do, trying to protect his guy. I don't have any problem with Mike Schilt saying nice things about Michael Wacha. He knows exactly what he's saying, and we know exactly what we're seeing. If you don't recognize that Mike Schilt is simply trying to protect his player and make his player feel better about himself, then you don't have any idea about what reading between the lines is.
No, here's the thing. He is right now in an impossible position because no matter what he does, somebody is going to be upset with him. If he is brutally honest and says, no, he wasn't any good and we have to have better, we need better from the entire team, you run the risk of pissing off your players. But if you say what he did and you kind of you frame it that way, you have an entire fan base who can see with their own eyes.
Yeah.
They're not stupid. People watching these games are not dumb. Well, some might be, but most are not. And they know what's going on, and they're going to be like, look, don't try to sell me something that I can clearly see is not happening. Don't gaslight me here. I can see this for myself. So he's kind of in a no-win situation. So I'm not exactly sure what he is supposed to say. It's still a, you know, if you can remove yourself from it and take out all feeling, it's kind of amusing when you hear somebody get up in front of you and say, nah, he looked pretty good today.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, it looked really good coming off the bat, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, it did. And there were some sinkers that were unhittable.
Well, I mean, when they're in the dirt.
Exactly.
It's difficult to hit.
Yeah.
But I follow you.
Yeah.
You're exactly right.
So
that pitch to the backstop was unhittable. Yes, you're right about that.
It was good stuff. You remember Joel Quenneville? You were with him in Chicago, and one of his great lines here was, "I didn't mind him. I didn't mind him." It was all, you know, that's the kind of thing that Schilt is dealing with at the moment, and his demeanor with the media hasn't changed. He's still as accessible as he was, and he's doing everything he can to spin this thing. Look, the Cardinals, having lost three in a row, has zero reflection on Mike Schilt's management over the last three
years. Look, and I don't know. You may know how I feel about managers in general. I don't think they're completely pointless. I do think they are necessary, but I also think that the amount of influence they can have on what actually happens on the field is kind of limited. Other than pitching changes, you know, you could be smart about pitching changes, double switches, whatever. That stuff can matter, but for the most part, it's 95% players. Those players have to do what they're capable of doing because you have to figure that in the course of a typical game, there are about 300 pitches thrown, about, give or take. Each one of those pitches, the manager has nothing to do with the outcome. It's a guy on a mound. He's throwing a baseball at a guy standing there with a bat, and that's what matters. And that guy at the plate can conceivably score on every single pitch. Mm-hmm. So the manager's influence, I think we tend to blame them when it's not really their fault most of the time.
And as far as ripping into the players, let me tell you something. I covered on a daily basis three Hall of Fame managers, Herzog, Torrey, La Russa. None of those guys individually ripped players. Some were more forthcoming and more honest than others, but they understand also that fans see what they see.
Right.
And the one thing Joe Torre said every single day, and he drove it into my head, and I think there's a lot of people among us as fans that don't get this. This game is not easy. It is hard to do what Michael Wacha tried to do last night. And He is not what he was. He's a diminished Michael Wacha. But to think that any guy can just go out there and shut the Dodgers down for seven innings is completely wrong.
I don't think the majority of people really believe that. I think what it is you look at your team, where it is, and then you look at where the Dodgers are, and you go, that's what I want. I want my team to look like that. I want my team to be in the position that everybody doesn't have to be firing on all cylinders in order for us to be really good, where they can have some guys struggling, but that team is so stacked, they're going to win a lot of games, or be like the Astros. I think that's really what it comes down to. Or they say, I want my team to have done more at the deadline so we don't have to have Michael Wacha starting games instead of having him in the bullpen. I don't really think it's a, well, I can do better. I know people say, I can do better than this guy, but it's hyperbole and they know it.
Do you remember in Space Jam when the Toons took the basketball powers away from Michael Jordan?
Sort of.
During the 2013 NLCS, Stan Kasten, the president of the Dodgers, said in the dugout, before the series started, or before the first game here in St. Louis, he said, when talking about the Cardinals, that's the organization that we want to model ourselves after. This is when they had that outrageous payroll, and they had Carl Crawford, and they made the trade for Gonzalez, and Adrian Gonzalez. They just had an outrageous payroll. And he said, pointing across the field, he said, that's the model organization for us. What's happened is the Dodgers have stolen that model, and the Cardinals are kind of like the Michael Jordan team right now. They've had their mojo stolen.
Yeah, and so they have to find a way to get back to that.
Yeah.
Which, how do you do it? And that's the kind of thing that we can parse here forever, and if we knew for sure how to do it, we'd probably be in a different capacity. We probably wouldn't be doing this. We might actually be working for them. But I think what we can say is that the routes they're taking now, whatever it is not really working as far as being a dominant franchise. They're a franchise that competes, but I don't think people want, and I don't think they're wrong for this either. I don't think the average fan is wrong to expect a team that has the second best attendance in baseball. So that means a ton of support. Mm-hmm. It is one of the very top supportive fan bases in all of sports. I think what they want is to be rewarded with a team that is not just a little bit above average and has a chance of maybe getting a wild card or who knows if mm-hmm. all things go right, winning a division. What they want is to see this team win the division every year for seven straight years like the Dodgers. And maybe that's a little unrealistic, but I think they want something closer to that than what they've gotten the last 4 years. And I think that's fair.
And part of what you need to do is, and the Dodgers have done this, first of all, you need to do a great job of professional evaluation.
Yes.
Austin Barnes, who was just sent down, and Enrique Hernandez came to them in a trade. I think it was like 4 years ago, 5 years ago. It was Enrique Hernandez and Austin Barnes coming from the Marlins in exchange for D. Gordon. It was the D. Gordon, Dan Heron trade. So they did really well with that. They got Barnes and Enrique Hernandez. Then they've done great finding a guy like Max Muncy, finding
right.
a guy like Chris Taylor.
Turner.
Justin Turner. Yeah. They get Cody Bellinger with a fourth-round pick. They get Walker Buehler with a pick that the Cardinals could have gotten him with. They are able to get Corey Seager late in the first round. Mm-hmm. If you have late first-round picks, you have to make those babies stick. And the Dodgers have done a better job than any organization, especially since they started winning these divisions the last 7 years, of getting guys with late picks. Jock Peterson was a third rounder, I believe. Let me double check here. But he was an 11th rounder. So the Cardinals have to do a better job of drafting stars late.
Well, that's one of the things they have to do for sure. They also have to know when to part with their young players or even veteran players, the Tommy Pham's, for example. They have to know when to do that and when not to. And I know that from the sounds of it, there were some people internally that didn't really like Pham and the way he was, the way he acted. Well, I'd much rather have Tommy Pham in my organization, a guy who works hard and wants to win all the time. I would be more than happy to still have him around. I kind of understood it from the information I had. There's some concern about the eye issue and when that's going to be a problem again. So from that perspective, I get it. But one of the things we hear all the time from people who work in front offices or managers or any coach, anybody who works with a team is, we have more information than you do. So, you know, trust us on this because there's more that we know internally than the fan knows. Okay, well, then it's on you because you have more information to make better decisions. Mm-hmm. So that's it's not just drafting better. Yes, they're going to have to do that, be better in the later rounds, but they're also going to have to be smarter about when to let go of certain players and when not to, and they have not done a good job of that lately.
Obviously, Mike Shildt's comments, and to just go back to the beginning here, losing 8-0 to the Dodgers, losing 3 in a row, that's not a Mike Shildt issue. But Shildt specifically last night with the comments about Waka, a bold-faced lie. Well, we want to know what ridiculously obvious lies you have told or tried to get away with. Use the mic drop feature. What's the best lie you've ever told to a spouse, to a boss, to a parent? What's the best you've ever told?
To law enforcement?
Yeah. We want to hear from you with the mic drop feature on the 101 ESPN app, and we have a sample of this.
Hey, guys, I just got to say, Chris Ranji is the best guy on air in St. Louis. Heck, might be in sports talk. I mean, the guy's got great points. He's hilarious on the air. The voice is pretty solid when he's on the air as well. I mean, I don't listen to anybody other than Chris Ranji when I'm listening to sports talk radio.
That sounded like Ferrario.
Maybe it was.
I think it was.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, that guy was being serious. I don't think he knew to send that to us.
By the way, Corey Seager was taken one spot ahead of Michael Walker, so the Cardinals did not have an opportunity to take Corey Seager with that pick. And let's see, that Walker was the first time the Cardinals chose that year, so they couldn't have had Corey Seager.
But they could have had Mike Trout, right?
I don't think they could have.
Or did they pick right after?
Randall Grichuk was taken before Trout.
That's right.
So that was, and he was taken by the Angels too, obviously. But no, unfortunately, the Cardinals, they don't have him.
That's a bummer.
They did draft James Ramsey that year also.
What number did they pick? 20?
With Waka? He was number 19.
Okay.
And that pick came from the Angels in exchange for Albert Pujols.
Nice.
That's what they got out of it. Next up in the fast lane, Zeke Elliott's holdout continues, and Joel Edmondson has a new contract with the Blues. That's next, your Hot Topics of the Day on 101 ESPN. Miles Michaelis and Clayton Kershaw tonight at Dodger Stadium in L.A. The Cardinals will try to snap a 3-game losing streak. Michaelis 7-11 with a 4.00 earned run average. Kershaw, his typical great self, 10-2 with a 2.85. At some point, Clayton Kershaw has to win in the postseason, doesn't he? He has to become a great postseason pitcher.
Well, people used to complain about A-Rod, or at least give him a hard time for not being good in the playoffs, and then he did have that one really good postseason. So you would think eventually it's going to happen for him.
Hope
right?
So. Yeah.
What if it's maybe he just wears down by that point of the year and he's not, he's always having some kind of back problem or something. Maybe he just is never quite right in the playoffs.
It might be. By the way, Miles Michaelis with a 1.98 earned run average at Busch Stadium this year and a 6.75 earned run average away from Busch. As a matter of fact, he has 41 strikeouts and 53 in the third innings on the road, 41 and 53 in the third, 49 at home and 72 in the third.
Well, as we have highlighted multiple times before, it seems the Cardinals pitching staff in its entirety has a lot of difficulty away from their home ballpark, which is actually a pretty hitter-friendly ballpark, so maybe that's part of it.
There is one day game, was one day game, the White Sox over the Tigers played in the rain in Detroit. White Sox win it by a score of 5-3. Joel Edmondson and the Blues went to arbitration, and Edmondson was awarded a one-year contract for $3.1 million. Our Blues insider from The Athletic, Jeremy Rutherford, tweeting that the Edmondson arbitration ruling leaves the Blues with approximately $2.7 million in cap space, and Ivan Barbashev left to sign And JR says that he would guess that Barbashev, and who doesn't have arbitration rights, will fall in the $1.3 to $1.5 million range, and that would leave the team with a little over $1 million left in cap space.
And I think that's he wanted a little bit of a buffer, Doug Armstrong did, right, once the regular season started, that if they were to do anything in the middle of the year, they had some space that they could work with. I think that's pretty good. First of all, we can't really be too awfully upset with anything they do this season because they just won the freaking cup. And if you don't know this rule, there's like a 4 to 5 year grace period where it's five, right?
Yep.
Where you cannot really be upset and complain after your team has won a championship.
Yeah. Not 52, by the way.
No, 52 is not acceptable. But once that 5 years is up, man, you can jump
right
back on.
Then we can start ripping again.
Absolutely.
Football, Zeke Elliott says he will not play for the Cowboys without a new contract. According to Josina Anderson of ESPN, it is not likely that Elliott's holdout continues into the regular season based on the belief that Cowboys owner Jerry Jones wants to get a new deal done with Zeke before week one. But he says no contract, no play.
Well, you can keep going this direction. I think they, for this season in particular, he makes them better. I don't think there's any question about that. But with the way we've seen NFL teams operate, and I know that he's capable of doing more than just being a pounded up the middle running back, and we understand that. But teams have been willing to not really invest very much there. So this might work out well for him, and I think he's going to end up getting some kind of money here. It's probably not going to be exactly what he wants, but I do think eventually he's going to get something. I guess this is the only play you have at this point if you're a running back, is to sit out and hope the team caves.
Be Le'Veon Bell.
Exactly. Or I think it was either you that said it last weekend, maybe it was BT. Just wait until they start the season 0-2, and then Jerry Jones will pick up that phone and he'll make it happen.
He did it with Emmett, and he'll do it with Zeke.
But if they start off 2-0, I'd start to sweat if I were Zeke Elliott.
Tom Brady just signed a new contract with the Patriots, and now he and his wife Giselle have placed their Brookline, Massachusetts home on the market for $39.5 million. That's an expensive home.
I would think it's nice, probably.
I would think so.
At 39 mil?
I would think. Yeah, we have to find that on Zillow or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently they're looking at homes in New Jersey and Connecticut. And they sold, did you know they sold their L.A. home, the one that had the moat? They sold it to Dr. Dre?
I did not know that.
Yeah, they did. So
okay.
I guess their home base now is in New England.
Do they have a home in New Orleans? Or
I don't
am I
believe
thinking
so.
Of somebody
no, I think
else?
They still have their a different L.A. home.
Okay.
But not the $40 million home that they built.
Okay. Somebody, and I can't remember who it is now, but somebody has a lot of people do, in the French Quarter. Those places are extremely expensive. Like
well,
millions.
John Goodman, St. Louis and John Goodman. Sandra Bullock is down there.
Oh, yeah.
There's another.
Oh, I think Brad Pitt and Angelina.
That's exactly right.
Yep. They may have sold it in the last several years, but they used to have one.
Yeah, I don't think they own anything together anymore.
Yeah, probably not.
No. Those are your hot topics of the day. And don't forget that we want to hear from you with some of the BS that Mike Schilt was putting out last night.
Poor that, Mike.
Yeah, well, but he's saying that what he saw was good, and it wasn't, and we saw that. So we want to know from you what ridiculously obvious lie you've tried to get away with. Send us a mic drop with the 101 ESPN app or leave us a text on the Hot Shots text line 65780 because we want to hear your fantastical lies here on 101 ESPN. It'd be great. There you go.
I don't have any of those. I'm always truthful.
Yes, you are.
I'll think of something.
You're brutally honest.
That's
brutally.
Right.
Well, Joel Edmondson has a new contract with the Blues, and we're going to break it down with our Blues insider, Jeremy Rutherford, next on 101 ESPN. The Blues announced today that defenseman Joel Edmondson has been awarded $3.1 million in a one-year deal for the 2019-2020 season. Edmondson went to arbitration asking for $4.2 million. The Blues had offered $2.3 million. And Doug Armstrong said, quote, "We are happy to have Joel under contract for next season. He is an important part of our defensive unit, and we are looking forward to another successful year." Eddie is 26 years old, had only 11 points last year after a really good offensive year the year before, and he did have 68 penalty minutes and was benched a lot, too. Our Blues insider from The Athletic is Jeremy Rutherford, who's with us now on the Brown and Crouppen Celebrity Line on 101 ESPN. JR, how you doing?
Doing well, Mr. Randy Carricker. How you doing?
Everything's great. Let's start with this. It seemed like the arbitrators split the difference here, basically, with Edmondson and the Blues.
Yeah, you threw out the numbers there. Eddie's camp asked for 4.2, and the Blues are about 2.3. It breaks down to 3.25 is the middle point. And the arbitration ruling came in today at 3.1, so slightly under that middle point. But I think it was about where probably the sides expected it to be. Joel Edmondson, you just mentioned his stats last year. We all know we've been watching him for several years now. He's not necessarily an offensive player. He does have a little upside there on occasion, but primarily he is a physical stay-at-home defenseman who can move the puck for you. The difficulty for Joel Edmondson last year is I just don't think he was completely the type of player that you'd hope him to be in terms of that physicality, because you know, you look at the Blues' fourth line over the years, the past couple of years, that's gone away. The Kyle Brodziak, Ryan Reeves days are gone, and we saw last year you've got some guys that can play, so you need a little bit of that edge on your team, and I think they expect Joel Edmondson to be that guy for them. So it wasn't the type of year that he would hope for, but I think that on a one-year deal at $3.1 million, he'll be unrestricted next year, so he's in control of the situation now that he's got the one-year deal.
And JR, if I'm not mistaken, Joel Edmondson has had three position coaches in 3 years, and then you add in Larry Robinson. He's had a lot of different voices in his head as he's tried to ascend as an NHL player. I wonder if that has an effect, kind of like the quarterback with the different offensive coordinators every year, if people are telling him different ways to go about playing.
I think that that's been brought up. That's an observation some have made over the past couple of years, not with just Joel Edmondson, but the entire Blues defensive core. And, you know, obviously they played terrific defense under Ken Hitchcock, but, you know, when you go through the list of defensive coaches they've had the past couple of years with a Brad Shaw, with a Rick Wilson, with a Daryl Sador, you know, and then now you have Mike Van Ryan, you know, that's a lot of turnover on the defensive side of the coaching staff the past couple of years. And, you know, so I think it can have an effect on a young player. You know, I don't know that I'd make that excuse for a couple of these guys who've been around for a while. They've primarily played the same style. I just think when it comes to Joel Edmondson, he knows what his game is. He knows what the team expects from him. And he said it a couple weeks ago when I wrote the article, Randy, that, yeah, his offensive numbers weren't there, but he'd like to bring what the team expects of him.
Speaking of turnovers, a word you mentioned, that was kind of the problem with him as you got later into the season. And he would play well, but then he would have those really frustrating moments, you know, offensive zone turnovers, which turn into goals going the other direction. I mean, stuff like that would happen. And it wasn't exclusive to him. That was sort of at least a handful of players had those sorts of issues. Is that the kind of thing they really feel like they can clean up when it comes to him and the rest of the crew?
Yeah, I think so, Ron. You know, obviously it was a horrible start to the season defensively. You know, I think when they got a little more used to each other and, you know, made some tweaks on the defensive side, the group as a whole got better. With Joel Edmondson, I don't know if it was you know, the pressure of the contract. Keep in mind that last year, knowing that the Blues did not have the dollars to sign him to a long-term deal because they were up against the cap last year when he signed, he agreed to that one-year $3 million deal. And so he knew that he had to play well if he wanted that long-term deal. And, you know, players deal with it differently. I don't know how much that factored into his play. But, you know, he just didn't move the puck and do a lot of things as clean as he had in the past. So, you know, even though he's added some offense, we saw that a couple years ago in the Minnesota series in the playoffs, you know, I think he's a guy who can give you a little bit in that area. But to me, it's always the same with players. You know, stick to your bread and butter. Stick what got you into the lineup. That's what the team's looking for. And I think when Joel Edmondson does that, he shouldn't come out of the top six. But the play dropped off last year, and, you know, it reflected in him being pulled out of the top six and being a healthy scratch. So if you would have told me that going into the playoffs I'm sorry, going into the season last year, that Joel Edmondson would have been a healthy scratch at times, and particularly in the playoffs, I wouldn't have believed it. But that's what the depth is on the blue line right now for the Blues, and he's got to climb back into that mix.
Our outstanding Blues insider, Jeremy Rutherford of The Athletic, with us on 101 ESPN. And fans have been paying attention to you and tweeting you all summer long about this jigsaw puzzle with the salary cap. How does the $3.1 million that Edmondson gets affect Ivan Barbashev, and how do both of them affect the possibility of Pat Maroon coming back?
Yeah, so if you look at the Blues salary cap right now, if you go to Cap Friendly, let's say, they had them before the Edmondson ruling at about $5 million left. But if you take out Derek Pouliot, the defenseman, because he'd likely start the year in the minors, that gives him an additional $700,000. That'll come off the NHL salary cap. So they had 5.7, and you take off the 3.1 for Joel Edmondson, that leaves them, Randy, with about $2.7 million left in salary cap space. Now, you still have to sign Ivan Barbashev. He's a guy looking for about $2 million. You know, I think when it's all said and done, he's probably going to be in the 1-5 range. He doesn't have any arbitration rights this year. No leverage other than to sit out. And you'd think that, you know, a fourth-line young player trying to get some traction wouldn't do that. So hypothetically, if Barbashev signs at about $1.5 million, you're looking at about $1 million in salary cap space, and I don't see that that allows you to fit Pat Maroon in. To me, if Pat Maroon's going to be a part of this team, the Blues are going to have to make some sort of deal. And I believe, big picture, with the way Doug Armstrong wants to go into a season with some sort of cushion under that salary cap, if Barbashev's anything above 1.5 and close to $2 million, you're talking about $1 million under the salary cap. You know, I think that Doug Armstrong might consider a move to free him up some space there.
So if that is the case and they can't make a move they want to free up some of that space and they end up right up against the cap, obviously they don't want that, but, I mean, in the end, isn't that okay?
Yeah, no, I think so, but it's just once you get into the season and you're playing with, you know, a few $100,000 under the salary cap, it just makes things a little more difficult in terms of guys that you want to bring up or can't bring up, or if you have injuries and, you know, now you have decisions of putting guys on long-term injury reserve. You know, you have the situation, too. You can, you know, send guys to the minors, but you're paying them that one-way salary. So, you know, guys that are probably in the discussion, if the Blues were to make a move, I know a lot of people have asked about that. It's not going to be Jake Allen. They feel comfortable with their goalie situation right now. Joel Edmondson, is he a possibility? People have been asking me today about whether a guy who goes through the arbitration process, if he's trade eligible. You know, I just learned that he could be traded. He's a guy who's been mentioned in those conversations. Robbie Fabry, another guy who, even after the injury last year, didn't seem to get back into the good graces and get back to the lineup regularly. So I just think Doug Armstrong's history and the fact that every time you talk to him about the salary cap going into the season, Ronge, he's always talking about having that $2.5 million cushion, and this just doesn't get him there, the numbers that you're looking at right now.
And I know that one thing that Doug Armstrong wants to do, and he actually told us right after the season ended, and this was before free agency, is he said, I want to bring back 95% of this roster, and the only question was Patrick Maroon for him. I get the sense that the Blues really do want to give that group that they had win the Stanley Cup another opportunity to win the Stanley Cup all together.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I think in a perfect world, you know, if you could bring a Patrick Maroon back on the cheap, and he's a guy who maybe you didn't pencil into your top nine every night, but he's a guy who you felt like you could put him in the lineup and help you. You know, I think they'd bring him back. But if you're talking $2 million and you're talking a two-year term, I don't think that that's going to interest the Blues. They do have some guys who are ready to go. Zach Sanford showed that in the Stanley Cup playoffs. Also, as Sammy Blay did, you want to work in Jordan Kyrou when he's ready back from the knee injury. And at some point, you're going to have to give Clem Costin a chance. So I think that's how they see the team evolving. So if you look at it now, salary cap consideration and also trying to give those young guys a shot, I think this is probably the avenue they're going to take, Randy.
We have a pretty good idea of how the rest of the conference is going to look, and we were promised, or we felt that what the Blues were going to be into the season was promising. They looked good. They had a terrific offseason last year. We know how things started. Certainly, we know how they finished. But now as you look at them up against the rest of the West, and again, we have a pretty good idea how everyone is going to look going into the year. What do you think of this Blues team compared to the rest of the conference?
Yeah, you know, it's tough because we talked about that going into last season, and it seems though as though that however tough you think the Central is, they seem to get better every offseason, and that's the case again this year when you look at some of the moves that have been made. Look, Chicago's had trouble with the goaltending, and Corey Crawford's had trouble staying healthy, so they bring in Robin Leonard, and now they got a pretty good punch there. You look at Dallas, what they've done, and they bring in Pavelski and Corey Perry. You know, Dallas is a team that I thought could take off last year, and maybe this is their year. So, you know, I'll probably say the same thing I said about the Blues going into last year. I felt like they were good for third in the division. They were in the conversation, you know, to finish in the top two, but I liked them three. And for the first few months of that season, I looked like I was way off. But, you know, they did get into the top three. So with the moves that have been made in the Central, it's going to be a difficult division to play in again this year. But I do think with the confidence the Blues got and the knowledge, the experience that playoff run gave all these guys, the one thing they'll tell you, hey, do we have anybody that's played Stanley Cup extensively in the past? Just Oscar Sundquist last year, but now they all have. They all have that experience. So I think that's going to help them a lot in this very, very difficult division.
JR, you're always awesome. Thanks so much for the time. We appreciate it. Thanks for so much for the insight, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, boys.
See you, brother. That is our friend Jeremy Rutherford from The Athletic on 101 ESPN. Next up, we've got a new fighter coming your way in the 4 o'clock fight on 101 ESPN.